let alone in trying to apply them in a real-world setting. This idea explains the Southwest Airlines first class and suggests another empirical question, which Philip Goff, a bright and energetic new graduate student in my lab who had long been thinking about these issues, wanted to take up. He moved me in that direction, too. Our goal was to learn whether stereotype threat, in addition to its effects on performance, was also a common cause of tension between people from different groups in a society, a tension that, presumably, could drive Americans apart. But are Americans still being driven apart? When one thinks about factors that have traditionally isolated Americans from one another, many of them seem more muted today than in earlier times. American racial attitudes, for example, have grown consistently more accepting throughout the post-World War II era. Participation in virtually all aspects of American life throughout this same period has grown consistently more diverse, from the worlds of sports and entertainment to those of high-ranking CEOs, and of course, most recently, in the presidency of the United States. The America projected in the media is enviably diverse. So were Americans still being driven apart? As Phil and I scanned the horizon for harder evidence on this question, images of intergroup harmony began to chip at the edges. Even some major cracks began to emerge, and the cracks weren't all along racial lines. In his recent book, On Paradise Drive, the New York Times columnist David Brooks draws our attention to a general problem. We Americans are becoming more and more segregated into tinier and tinier enclaves of highly similar people, and this is happening around factors of much smaller significance than race. In large part, it reflects our pursuit of lifestyle and political preferences. Brooks takes the reader on a drive that begins in inner-city neighborhoods and progresses outward through the entering suburbs, high-income professional neighborhoods, and immigrant enclaves, all the way to the exurbs and rural areas. He describes these communities as isolated cultural zones. The people in them don't know much about people in the other zones, even when the zones border each other. In his words, human beings are capable of drawing amazingly subtle social distinctions and then shaping their lives around them. In the Washington, D.C. area, Democratic lawyers tend to live in suburban Maryland, and Republican lawyers tend to live in suburban Virginia. If you asked a Democratic lawyer to move from her $750,000 house in Bethesda, Maryland, in fall of 2003 prices, to a $750,000 house in Great Falls, Virginia, she'd look at you as if you had just asked her to buy a pickup truck with a gun rack and to shove chewing tobacco in her kid's mouth. In Manhattan, the owner of a $3 million Soho loft would feel out of place moving into a $3 million Fifth Avenue apartment. Brooks further notes that Americans move a lot. That is, we're more likely than people in many other societies to uproot ourselves and relocate even to distant communities. This gives us lots of chances to choose where we live, which gives us lots of chances to seek our own cultural zone, which over time makes these zones even more like themselves and ever more isolated from each other. In these ways, we're a nation of segregators. And sometimes that segregation does involve race. I occasionally think we Americans don't take enough credit for the significance of the civil rights movement, a public and law commitment to the ideal of a racially integrated society in virtually all of its aspects. I do not know of another society with such an explicit affirmation of this value, a major achievement of Brown versus Board of Education, the 1954 Supreme Court desegregation decision. But within 2 years of Brown, another Supreme Court decision granted school districts a more lenient standard of compliance. In the place of hard deadlines, it allowed all deliberate speed. In 1974, the court ruled against desegregation plans that spanned entire metropolitan areas as a means of integrating city and suburban schools. For predominantly minority cities with substantially white suburbs, this ruling made desegregation essentially impossible. Anti-busing protests and court suits have persisted since the 1954 decision. Over time, as the Harvard Civil Rights Project recently described, American schools have been resegregating. and the 185 school districts in the nation with enrollments of over 25,000 students, the vast majority were more racially segregated in 2000 than in 1986, often markedly so. For example, with the demise of the desegregation plan in Minneapolis, the average black student went to school with 33% fewer white students in 2000 than in 1986. Without desegregation plans, schools became as segregated as the neighborhoods that feed them. And those neighborhoods remain dramatically segregated, especially for whites. The 2000 census shows that the average white American lives in a neighborhood that is 80% white and 7% black, while the average black American lives in a neighborhood that is 33% white and 51% black. This holds for suburbs as much as for cities. If you wanted to rearrange most U.S. cities so that race played no role in where people lived, you would have to move 85% of the black population. Our history is still with us. In the face of such data, Phil and I felt we'd answered our background question. Segregation, along with many dimensions of human difference, remains a major feature of American life. This includes racial segregation, television images of American society, and presidential elections notwithstanding. Still, one might ask, so what? Why worry about our segregating tendencies? It's a free country. If segregating by group identity causes no harm, why shouldn't we do it if we want to? In this regard, The Economist, Glenn Lowry, in a recent book, The Anatomy of Racial Inequality, makes an interesting point. He says that whether or not one sees group segregation as problematic depends a lot on one's assumptions about the nature of people. One view is that people are more or less independent actors, making free choices about opportunities that are more or less equally available to everyone in society. On that assumption, segregation shouldn't have much effect. The life chances you get are largely a matter of your own choice, determination, talent, and the like. So why worry about group segregation? It might mean you would be a little less cosmopolitan, but that wouldn't have much to do with how fair society is. Another view, emerging especially in the social sciences, is that people, though capable of independent choice, do have a location in society. Their lives are located somewhere in its social, economic, and cultural structures, and in the networks of relationships that make up society. Being born into a low-income Appalachian family in the hills of eastern Kentucky is to take life on from a different location in society's opportunity structure than being born into a high-income family in the northern suburbs of Chicago. Different locations afford people different resources, different access to the social capital of skills, knowledge, opportunities, and life chances. Segregation affects location. When people are grouped or segregated on the basis of a characteristic like social class, race, or religion, it affects the resources and social capital that are available to them. As Lowry puts it, opportunity travels along the synapses of these social networks. Chapter 6. A fair amount of evidence supports him. In the early 1970s, for example, the sociologist Mark Granovetter asked several hundred professionals in Newton, Massachusetts, how they got their jobs. 56% pointed to a friend. Only 19% responded to an ad, and only 20% got their job by directly applying. The sociologist Nancy D. Tommaso recently expanded this line of investigation. For all of the jobs they ever had, she asked 246 people, 25 to 55 years old in New Jersey, Ohio, and Tennessee, whether they'd been told about the job by someone they knew, whether someone had put in a good word for them, and whether they knew the person who hired them. For the average job, she found that 60 to 90% of her respondents had benefited from one or another of these forms of social capital, and 98% of her respondents had benefited from at least one of these advantages for at least one of their jobs. Yet D. Tommaso's respondents were largely unaware of their advantages. Many interviewees said no one helped them. For example, a working-class male from New Jersey who had gotten into the union through his father and then into a steadier job through help from a friend said, "Did I earn it? Yeah, I worked for what I got. Definitely. Nobody gave me nothing. Nothing. When explaining our good fortune, we may remember our hard work and may be a bit too forgetful about the advantages of our social capital network. And of course, all networks are not created equal. It would surprise no one to find that people in wealthier locations and networks get easier access to better schooling, jobs, healthcare, and the like than people in less wealthy locations and networks. Think about the person I mentioned earlier who was born into a low-income Appalachian family in eastern Kentucky versus a person born into a high-income family in a wealthy suburb of Chicago. Think about Anatole Broillard when he was black versus when he was white. One way these people's locations differ is in the networks they offer. Networks that vary in opportunities, access to skills and knowledge, critical to success in society, access to people in the right places, and so on. This explains how seemingly ordinary associational preferences can have big effects. They influence who gets access to advantaging networks and who doesn't. This was Glenn Lowry's reasoning. It led him to a surprising claim. The everyday associational preferences that contribute to racially organized networks and locations in American life, that is, racially organized residential patterns, schooling, friendship networks, and so on, may now be more important causes of racial inequality than direct discrimination against blacks. He's not announcing the end of racial discrimination. He's simply underlining the importance of preferences that organize blacks out of networks and locations that could better their outcomes. He cites examples of these preferences. Among married persons 25 to 34 years old in 1990, some 70% of Asian women, 39% of Hispanic women, but only 2% of black women had white Anglo husbands. Racially mixed church congregations are rare enough to make front page news, so culturally isolated are black ghetto-dwelling teenagers that scholars find convergence in their speech patterns over great geographic distances, even as this emergent dialect grows increasingly dissimilar from the speech of poor whites living but a few miles away. Childless white couples travel to Colombia and China in search of infants to adopt, while ghetto-born orphans go parentless. Chapter 4. As a further example of this, I can't help recalling the results of the survey that I described in Chapter 2, in which the average black student walking across the University of Michigan campus in the early 1990s was found to have only 2/3 of a white friend among his or her top 6 friends, while the number of black friends that whites had was even smaller. Associations in the United States clearly have a racial structure. Recall from the minimal group studies described in Chapter 4 that all groups have in-group associational preferences, the less powerful and disenfranchised, as well as the more powerful and enfranchised. Thus, when getting into more advantaged networks would require relationships with people from an out-group, that is, when the less advantaged might have to develop relationships with the more advantaged out-group, these in-group preferences may get in the way. That said, almost by definition, the preferences of people already in advantaging networks will play a bigger role in determining who gets into them. As Phil and I sorted through this material, our suspicion that group prejudice wasn't the sole cause of group associational preferences grew stronger. We wondered whether identity threat didn't play a larger role in keeping Americans apart in the Southwest Airlines first class than was recognized. Yet, we also knew that interracial interactions were often quite comfortable. Looking out of my office window, we could see groupings of students as they came and went. They were often interracial, and their interactions easy. Perhaps the topic of conversation made the difference. There are lots of things to talk about that would allow whites to feel little risk of confirming the racist stereotype. The fate of the school's basketball team, for example. Other topics would not assure such safety. For instance, the role of police in stopping black undergraduates in town, or a student's failure in tutoring an elementary school minority student, and that is where identity threat might come in, adding real tension to the interaction. 2. But how to test all of this? How to test the role of identity threat in interracial interactions? We needed a way to measure the effect of identity threat on associational preference. Imagine, for example, that as a white person, you're waiting alone in a dentist's office as two black patients arrive and take seats near you. A conversation ensues. It starts as a commiserative chat about dental pain. Then it drifts towards politics and somehow finds its way to racial profiling, an issue of intense concern to your conversation partners. They believe they've experienced it. At this point, you're called into the doctor's office. But as you enter, the doctor leaves to finish a procedure with another patient. You return to the waiting room. Your former seat is taken. Two other seats are open, one next to your former conversation partners who are still discussing racial profiling, and one farther away that would put you at a safe distance from this conversation. Rejoining the conversation as a white person could put you under stereotype threat. That is, you could inadvertently say something on this charged topic that would cause you to be seen stereotypically. If identity threat of this sort affects associational preferences, then you might sit farther away from this risky conversation. But if identity threat has little effect on such preferences, you might just sit next to these guys and chat away. Which seat do you take? A situation like this might test whether identity threat, beyond any effect of prejudice, can affect one's preference to associate with other groups. A simple choice of seats would tell the story. Phil and I talked about many ways of setting this situation up in the laboratory. We gave several a dry run. Eventually, we came to the following. We brought white male Stanford University students into our laboratory, one at a time, explaining that as part of a study on social communication, they would have a conversation with two other students who were completing questionnaires in rooms down the hall. We took a Polaroid photograph of each participant and laid it on the table between Polaroids of their two conversation partners to begin getting them acquainted. The photographs revealed that their conversation partners were black. Next, half of the participants learned that their conversation would focus on love and relationships, and the other half learned that their conversation would focus on the more charged topic of racial profiling. This gave us two groups of white participants. One group expected to talk to two black guys about love and relationships, a topic that, in a pre-test survey, male students rated as something they would feel comfortable talking about with people from different groups. They seemed to feel little risk of saying something on this topic that would cause them to be seen as racially prejudiced. The other group expected to talk to two black guys about racial profiling, a topic that the same pretest survey showed would make these students very uncomfortable, putting them under a stereotype threat much like that in my dental office example. Was this threat enough to affect the group preferences of these participants? We measured these preferences in a simple way. After participants learned the topic of their conversation, the person conducting the experiment said that he would go down the hall to get the two other participants so that the conversation could begin. As he left, he pointed to three chairs clumsily grouped into the corner of the room and said, "Would you please do me a favor and arrange the three chairs for the conversation and then take a seat in your chair?" The participant was then left to arrange the chairs. When this was done, the experiment was essentially over. As you might surmise, our real interest was in how participants arranged the chairs, in particular, how close they placed their chair to the chairs of their two black conversation partners. These two distances, the distances between the participant's chair and the chairs of each of the two black conversation partners, were the basis of our measure of associational preference. We presumed that the greater these distances, like the choice of the more distant seat in the dental office, the less comfortable they anticipated being in the conversation. If anticipating a conversation with two black students about racial profiling causes enough stereotype threat for whites to prefer less association with blacks, then expecting this conversation should lead white participants to place their chairs farther away from black partners than they would when expecting an innocuous conversation about love and relationships. They should behave like the white passengers avoiding the black passenger on Southwest Airlines flights. That is what happened. Participants expecting the love and relationship conversation grouped the three chairs close together. Those anticipating the racial profiling conversation, however, while grouping their two partners' chairs close together, put their own chair a distance away. Interesting. But anybody might be uncomfortable talking to any stranger about racial profiling. It's a charged topic. Perhaps that is why participants seated themselves farther away from their partners when this was the conversation topic. To examine this possibility, we included two further groups of white male participants, one of which, just as before, expected a love and relationship conversation, and the other of which, just as before, expected a racial profiling conversation. But this time, the photographs both groups saw at the outset of the experiment revealed that their conversation partners would be white, not black. Talking to two white students about racial profiling should not cause nearly as much stereotype threat as talking to two black students about racial profiling. The results were clear. White participants in both of these groups put the chairs close together, regardless of the conversation topic. It wasn't just the racial profiling topic that led white participants to distance themselves from their black partners. But could we be sure that it was really fear of confirming the stereotype of whites as racist that was the cause of their distancing? To find out, we measured what participants were thinking about just before they arranged the chairs. By means of the procedure that Josh and I had used earlier, we asked them to complete a list of 80 word fragments, 10 of which could be completed as either a word related to the stereotype of whites as racists, or as a word not related to that stereotype. The fragment RAC, blank T, for example, could be completed as either racket or racist. Like a Rorschach test, this test measured what was just beneath the person's awareness. It showed something interesting. For participants expecting to talk to white partners or to black partners about love and relationships, the number of fragments they completed with stereotype words did not increase with the distance they sat from the partners. But for participants expecting to talk to black partners about racial profiling, the more fragments they completed with stereotype words, the farther they sat from their partners. This told us that the prospect of an interracial conversation on a racially sensitive topic made white participants mindful of the whites as racist stereotype. And the more mindful they were of the stereotype, the more they distanced themselves from black conversation partners. Worry about being stereotyped was driving them away. But there was another explanation still. Remember the question about what caused the Southwest Airlines first class? Identity threat or old-fashioned prejudice? The same question was relevant here. Did white participants distance themselves from black partners when the topic was racial profiling because of identity threat, as we surmised, or because of prejudice? Perhaps the more racially prejudiced participants in this group sat farther away from their partners, reflecting their prejudice, and then had to worry the most about being seen as prejudiced. We did another experiment. It used essentially the same procedures as the first, except this time, in a session 24 hours before the experiment began, we measured just how racially prejudiced our participants were. We measured both their conscious and unconscious prejudice. The conscious measure was the modern racism questionnaire. The unconscious measure was the implicit attitude test, IAT. The IAT measures one's unconscious or implicit attitude toward a given group, in this instance, African Americans. It's built on the principle that it takes longer for us to say we recognize a weak mental association. For example, between George W. Bush and the pop star Michael Jackson, who are associated only by being public figures in the same era, than to say we recognize a strong mental association, for example, between Laurel and Hardy of the classic comedy team. So if we are faster at recognizing associations between blacks and negative things, such as between blacks and crime, than at recognizing associations between blacks and positive things, such as between blacks and career success, and if the reverse holds for our associations with whites, then we have an implicit negative association toward blacks. That is, our associations toward them are unconsciously more negative than our associations toward whites. This interesting test, developed by the social psychologist Anthony Greenwald and Mazarin Banaji, is available for listeners to try out at www.implicit.harvard.edu. Because the IAT relies on the time it takes people to react to stimuli that are rapidly presented on a computer screen, it is difficult to fake. Our experiment, after taking these measurements, found the same thing as the first. White male participants expecting to talk about racial profiling seated themselves farther away from a black than from a white conversation partner. Participants expected only one conversation partner in this experiment. Most important, the distance they put between themselves and their black partners was not greater for more prejudiced than for less prejudiced participants. It was true regardless of how prejudice was measured, consciously with the modern racism scale or subconsciously with the IAT. This is an illuminating finding. Prejudice had no effect on distancing in this experiment. Admittedly, our sample of elite college students wasn't a very prejudiced lot. Still, some participants tested more prejudiced than others, and these differences in prejudice had no effect on how close they sat to their black partner for their conversation on racial profiling. What did affect how close they sat to their black partners was the same thing that affected it in the first experiment, how much they worried about confirming the whites as racist stereotype. A worry we measured in this experiment in exactly the same way we measured it in the first one, with word completions. When white male participants expected to talk to a black person about racial profiling, they feared confirming the stereotype, and the more they feared it, the farther away they sat. It wasn't prejudice that caused them to sit farther from their black partner's conversation. It was fear of being seen as racist, pure and simple. It was stereotype threat, a contingency of their white identities in that situation. It was probably this threat, too, rather than racial prejudice, that caused Ted's intense discomfort in his African-American political science class, and that caused at least some of the white passengers to give Cheryl Cashin her Southwest Airlines first-class seat, and that might make it difficult for white teachers to engage poor-performing minority students. Who needs the hassle? Stereotype threat, then, is one way our national history seeps into our daily lives. That history leaves us with stereotypes about groups in our society that can be used to judge us as individuals when we're in situations where those stereotypes apply. In the seat next to a black person on an airplane or interacting with minority students, for example. The white person in that situation will not want to be seen in terms of the stereotype of whites as racially insensitive. And the black person, for his or her part, will not want to be seen in terms of the stereotypes about blacks as aggressive or as too easily seen prejudice, and so on. Fighting off these possible perceptions on a long airline flight, or more famously, perhaps in a school cafeteria, could be more than either party wants to take on. They just want to have lunch or get to Cleveland. Avoidance becomes the simplest solution. The stress of handling those stereotypes in public is perhaps a prime source of the great American racial discomfort, or of the great American discomfort with difference more generally. The discomfort that David Brooks tells us sends Americans into communities that are more and more organized around finer and finer human distinctions. We may try to organize our residences, workplaces, and schools so as to achieve this avoidance, but with an increasingly diverse population and the American commitment to fairness of access, avoidance will likely be a failing strategy. We can run, but can we hide? Phil's and my reasoning thus far has a glum implication. Even if a magic wand waved away all of the prejudice in our society, there would still be pressures keeping us apart. As if that conclusion weren't glum enough, when this pressure is coupled with the American tendency to leave one's problems behind and move on, as Brooks notes, 16% of Americans move each year. You get a lot of energy in the direction of people segregating from one another. 3. This is a fairly dark tunnel, but Phil and I, now joined by Paul Davies, whom I introduced earlier, did an experiment that sought light at the end of it. A mindset that could make it easier to approach people who are different from us. The idea, again, came from the work of Carol Dweck, whom I introduced earlier. What white students perhaps worry about when talking to black students about racial profiling, we reasoned, following Carol's logic, is that a mistake in a conversation might confirm that they have a difficult-to-modify racism. They therefore shy away from the conversation. If so, we should be able to get them closer together if the conversation is presented as a learning opportunity. This would signal that the underlying skills involved are learnable, not immutable, and should take some of the apprehension out of the situation. Enough, perhaps, that they could put their chairs closer together. We ran the basic procedure of the experiment again, but this time, just before the participant was left to arrange the chairs for the conversation, as the experimenter ostensibly went down the hall to get a black conversation partner, the experimenter gave the participants an instruction. He said that tension was natural in a discussion of racial profiling, that it was difficult for everyone. He said that they should treat the conversation as a learning experience. That is, try to learn what they could about the issue, and more generally, about how to talk about charged issues with people who might have differing perspectives. Under this instruction, white male participants moved their chairs close to their black partner, as close as they were in any of the other groups in the experiment. What were they thinking about just before they arranged the chairs? The word fragments measure showed that, when they adopted a learning goal for their conversation, white participants no longer worried about being seen as racist. They now completed no more word fragments with stereotype-related words, words that meant racism, than participants who were not under stereotype threat. Prejudice between groups is still a major cause of group segregation throughout the world. Simply teaching people to have learning goals when interacting with people from different groups may not alone cure all of these prejudices. No silver bullets exist in this business. Still, this finding offers hope. When it is identity threat that keeps people apart and uncomfortable with each other, that prevents passengers from sitting next to each other on airplanes. That discourages students from taking courses with substantial numbers of minority students in them. Or that may make teachers reluctant to approach some minority students. Then learning goals might help. With a learning goal, mistakes become just mistakes, not signs of immutable racism. Before we discovered Carol's idea of learning goals, we had some interesting failures. We had tried to find some instruction that would enable the participants expecting the challenging conversation to move their chairs closer. We tried first to assure them that they wouldn't be judged by what they said in the conversation, that they should feel free to speak their minds without fear of recrimination. It didn't work. Perhaps they didn't believe us. Those who anticipated talking to black partners about racial profiling still sat farther away. Next, we assured them that differences in perspective were valued, that a range of perspectives was appreciated in these conversations. This didn't work either. Chairs were still placed far apart, sometimes even farther apart than if we'd said nothing. These strategies seemed reasonable to us. We'd gotten them from some of the diversity training programs we'd seen. We'd used them sometimes in our own classes, but they had an unforeseen consequence. The more we assured participants that we wouldn't hold their words against them, the more they feared we would. Paranoid? Yes. But it is not entirely irrational in a psychology experiment or in a diversity workshop, for that matter, where one can feel at risk of being judged. And that's the point. It's difficult to just assure away the stereotype threat that whites can feel in interracial situations, such as having a conversation with black colleagues about racial profiling, or that any group can feel in situations where negative stereotypes about them are relevant. For assurances like these to work in classrooms, workplaces, or diversity workshops, or indeed for any group relations technique to work, people have to be able to trust that, despite the relevance of a bad stereotype about their group, they won't be judged by it, that their goodness as human beings will be seen. Trust like that is hard to come by. Chapter 9 offers a number of what I hope are suggestive ways of achieving it. But here, I stress again the value of learning goals. When interactions between people from different backgrounds have learning from each other as a goal, it eases the potential tension between them, giving missteps less significance. Trust is fostered. Stereotype threat, then, is a general phenomenon. It happens to all of us all the time. Negative stereotypes about our identities hover in the air around us. When we are in situations to which these stereotypes are relevant, we understand that we could be judged or treated in terms of them. If we are invested in what we're doing, we get worried. We try to disprove the stereotype or avoid confirming it. We present ourselves in counter-stereotypical ways. We avoid situations where we have to contend with this pressure. It's not all determining, but it persistently, often beneath our awareness, organizes our actions and choices, our lives, like how far we walk down the aisle of an airplane to find a seat, or how well we do on a round of golf, or on an IQ test. We think of ourselves as autonomous individuals. After all, we make choices. But we often forget that we make choices within context, always. And pressure tied to our social identities is a component of these contexts. This is difficult to appreciate by reflecting on our experience. And yet, as I've urged throughout this book, it is precisely these pressures that make a social identity real for us. Stereotype threat is a broad fact of life. Chapter 11. Conclusion. Identity as a bridge between us. Since the election on November 4th, 2008, of Barack Obama as President of the United States, the first African-American president, there has been much talk about whether American society has entered a post-racial era in which racial identity no longer plays an important role in our opportunities or in relations with one another. It is a hope stirred by the election itself, and it extends to other group prejudices as well. At base, it is a hope that some essence in the American character has changed or evolved to the point of freeing us, going forward, from prejudice-based injustice, a problem left behind. Aristotle believed that objects fell at different speeds because they had internal essences, like earthiness, that differed in how attracted they were to the earth, and thus how fast they made the object fall to get there. We seem to think, too, that we can gauge our progress toward an identity-fair society by measuring an internal entity, intergroup prejudice, that we believe causes racial, gender, class, and other group injustices. If that barometer drops to zero, the idea goes we would have a racially fair and identity-fair society, a level playing field, a post-racial society. I, for one, would love to see that barometer fall to zero. But would that mean we'd have a post-racial society? The thrust of Whistling Vivaldi has been to offer a broadened view of what makes a social identity, like our race, important to us and to society. It isn't just the prejudicial attitudes of others toward the identity, but also the contingencies that go with it in key settings. Prejudice matters. It can shape contingencies. But identity contingencies can profoundly affect a person to the point of shaping her life without her encountering a single prejudiced person along the way. When I look over my life as an African American, I see improvements in the contingencies attached to that identity. The swimming pool restrictions of my youth are gone. So are the suffocating limitations Anatole Broillard would have faced as a black man in New York City in the late 1940s. Things have gotten better. But remember, contingencies grow out of an identity's role in the history and organization of a society, its role in the DNA of society, and how society has stereotyped that identity. In the case of race in the United States, that history and its legacies are still with us. The racial segregation of our schools, as we noted in the preceding chapter, is steadily increasing, not decreasing. Reflecting the long history of racial subordination in the United States, the average black family today has only 10 cents of wealth for every dollar of wealth the average white family has, and so on. As William Faulkner famously said, the past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past. In fact, the social psychological contingencies tied to race, while evolving, are nonetheless tenacious. Take the case of higher education. Until the 1960s, the identity contingency that African Americans worried most about was that, on the basis of race, they couldn't get into most colleges and universities in the United States. Or that, if admitted, they would be in such small numbers and subjected to such segregating restrictions as to make the option highly unattractive. This contingency is hardly present at all in the lives of black college applicants today. Yet, As the research examined in these pages shows, the stereotype and identity threats that can arise in today's racially integrated colleges, especially those with an accumulation of identity-threatening cues, can be formidable. Not as diminishing of life chances as the total exclusion of yesteryear, but an unfortunate suppression of human potential nonetheless. Whites, too, in these more diverse settings, may confront tenacious forms of identity threat. They regularly meet blacks and other minorities now, which means they regularly face the possibility of being judged in terms of negative stereotypes about whites, reactions to which we saw acted out in the experiments by Philip Goff, Paul Davies, and me, described in Chapter 10. This is why we don't yet have a post-racial society. Our racial attitudes are indeed improving. Surveys show we oppose interracial marriage less. Whites report being more comfortable working for a black boss. More Americans would be happy living next door to a person of a different race. And there is that election of an African-American president. But it is contingencies in our lives, not racial attitudes alone, that count. And just because those contingencies are increasingly social-psychological doesn't mean they're gone. My mission in this audiobook is to broaden our understanding of human functioning, to get us to keep in mind that, especially in identity-integrated situations, people are not only coping with the manifest tasks of the situation, but are also busy appraising threat and protecting themselves from the risk of being negatively judged and treated. Perhaps the chief discovery of our research is that this protective side of the human character can be aroused by the mere prospect of being negatively stereotyped, and that once aroused, it steps in and takes over the capacities of the person, to such an extent that little capacity is left over for the work at hand. It shows that this side of the human character, aroused this way, affects our thoughts, emotions, actions, and performances in ways that have nothing to do with our internal traits, capacities, motivations, and so on, and that these effects contribute importantly to group differences in behavior, ranging from math performance to the interest shown in interracial conversations to playing golf. We could pry into the hearts and minds of people as deeply as science would allow, looking for their true prejudices, and all the while miss the fact that on any given day, their behavior toward blacks, for example, is determined mainly by a simple stereotype-driven predicament of identity that would affect most people who share their identity. Or we could give women 1,000 tests to measure their capacity for mathematics and overlook that, in this society, from the time they first engaged mathematics, they did so under the extra pressure of an identity threat that was especially strong at the frontier of their math skills, and that made the whole activity seem like the unfriendly territory of another group. Or we could get times for the 100-meter dash from every major track meet in the world in search of white athletes' true running capacity and miss the reality that in the United States, ever since these runners began running fast, they did so under the almost complete societal consensus that running fast was the domain of another group. This adds an ingredient to our understanding of group differences. It doesn't ignore the internal. It just broadens the palette of explanations. Without this broadened palette, you couldn't explain why changing the conception of a test from being diagnostic of ability to being a puzzle that is non-diagnostic of ability brings black performance to the same level as white performance on the Raven's Progressive Matrices IQ test, totally eliminating the typical racial gap in IQ scores. Or why changing the definition of a golfing task from its being a measure of natural athletic ability to its being a measure of sports strategic intelligence completely reversed the performance ranking of white and black participants. Or why reminding women math students about strong women role models just before they took a difficult math test could eliminate their typical underperformance on the test in relation to equally skilled men. Or why describing a conversation with two African-American students as a learning opportunity could get white male students to move their chairs closer for a conversation on racial profiling. A central policy implication of the research discussed here is that unless you make people feel safe from the risk of these identity predicaments in identity-integrated settings, you won't succeed in reducing group achievement gaps or in enabling people from different backgrounds to work comfortably and well together. When this is not done, the protective side of the human character will hold sway over people and their resources. Addressing this need for safety won't completely remedy these problems, but the problems can't be remedied without attention to this need for safety. Along these lines, I've come to recognize that knowing how to address this side of the human character, especially in integrated settings, is an increasingly important skill for our teachers, managers, and leaders. It's not clear whether, without these skills, they could be effective in the increasingly diverse settings of our society. This is where the practical lessons of Whistling Vivaldi come in. They constitute a beginning literature on what goes into that skill set. They offer a hopeful approach to the challenges I've outlined. Internal characteristics are hard to change. Situational identity contingencies, the cues that signal them, and the narratives that interpret them are easier to change. That is illustrated by the practical findings emerging from this research in recent years. By changing the way you give critical feedback, you can dramatically improve minority students' motivation and receptiveness. By improving a group's critical mass in a setting, you can improve its members' trust, comfort, and performance in the setting. By simply fostering intergroup conversations among students from different backgrounds, you can improve minority students' comfort and grades in a setting. By allowing students, especially minority students, to affirm their most valued sense of self, you can improve their grades, even for a long time. By helping students develop a narrative about the setting that explains their frustrations while projecting positive engagement and success in the setting, you can greatly improve their sense of belonging and achievement, which, if done at a critical time, could redirect the course of their lives. The effectiveness of these strategies is not an argument for neglecting structural and other changes that would help unwind the disadvantages attached to racial, gender, class, and other identities in our society. Such changes have to remain an important focus, but we can make a good deal of progress by addressing identity threat in our lives. And doing so is a big part of unwinding the disadvantages of identity. It may not take us all the way there, but as I hope this book illustrates, it can take us closer than we may have recognized. And if we don't take that part of the journey, we won't get there at all. Still, we Americans are wary about focusing on identity. Could whatever gain it yields outweigh the divisiveness it might cause? Hasn't our use of race, for example, been one of our society's greatest shames? This is a big part of why we so want Obama's election to have marked the beginning of a post-racial era, to put that shame behind us. It is perhaps ironic, then, in light of these hopes, that while Obama himself called for Americans of all identities to come together to build an era of progress, he didn't call for a post-racial society or interpret his election as a sign that such a society had arrived. To the contrary, he stressed his racial and other identities, openly embraced them, wrote books about how important they were for him to understand and incorporate into his sense of self. He hungered for a strong, developed racial identity. Here he is in his own words on March 18, 2008, during his famous Philadelphia race speech in the heat of his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination. "I am a son of a black man from Kenya and white woman from Kansas. I was raised with the help of a white grandfather who survived a depression to serve in Patton's army during World War II and a white grandmother who worked on a bomber assembly line at Fort Leavenworth while he was overseas. I've gone to some of the best schools in America and lived in one of the world's poorest nations. I am married to a black American who carries within her the blood of slaves and slave owners, an inheritance we pass on to our two precious daughters. I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue, scattered across three continents, and for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible." In this passage, Obama is not hiding his racial identities, but embracing them, not advocating a colorblind or post-racial society, but pointing to the many colors that make up the society and himself. He is putting identity and his multiple identities forward, using them as a bridge. In a society leery of identity, this could seem counterintuitive. Indeed, his staff advised him against this speech. Still, it may have gone farther than anything else he did to make non-black Americans comfortable with him as a candidate and eventually as a president. It established a common ground between Obama and a huge swath of the American electorate. We all have identities, often many of them. And despite important differences between identities, a lot of the experience of having one identity is like the experience of having another identity. That he talked about his multiple identities enabled people to see this, to see into their own identities and what that understanding could tell them about the identity experiences of others. These stories of his bridged Obama to the multitudes. They enabled people to see themselves in him. A man who, without these stories about his identities, ironically would have been just a black man. It also gave people, implicitly at least, a broader understanding of identities, that they are not rooted in unalterable essences that control the character of a person all the time. Important as identities are, people could see in Obama's experience that they don't capture or represent the whole person. They could see that identities are fluid, that their influence on us is activated by their situational relevance. It's a truth that many people sense in their own experience, and they apparently appreciated his having affirmed it. From this perspective, identity is less scary, less something to be wary of. In fact, exploring it might be helpful. Clearly, Obama gained from exploring his identities. It gave him self-awareness and poise, insight and empathy into the circumstances of other people's lives, a connection to a great range of people, and the social competence to get things done. In his example, identity wasn't a source of balkanization and threat. It was a source of wisdom about the challenges of a complex and diverse society that ultimately made him the most suitable person to lead such a society. To the surprise of all, perhaps, it was his stress on identity, not his suppression of it, that made him a symbol of hope. My hope for Whistling Vivaldi is that, in some small way at least, it will help to sustain that hope. This has been an Audible Inc. production of Whistling Vivaldi, Issues of Our Time, and Other Clues to How Stereotypes Affect Us, written by Claude M. Steele, narrated by DeMario, producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2010 by Claude M. Steele. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.